Mahalotcha. Let's start at the very beginning. Vaydaber Adonai Moshe Lemor, Daber El Aharon Va'amarta Ilav. Speak to Aharon and say to him, Mahalotcha Et HaNeirot. When you, we translate this, I suppose, when you light the Neirot, but when you make the lights go up, El Mul Panei HaMenorah, towards the face of the menorah, whatever that means, Ya'iru Shivat HaNeirot. The seven lamps should shine. Now, what Rashi says, Ya'iru Shivat HaNeirot, or Amul Pnei HaMenorah means, is that you've got the three lamps on one side and the three lamps on the other side, and each of them are pointing inwards. That's towards the center lamp. That's the way the Sforno says it as well. But other Mepharshim actually say, no, because it says, Ya'iru Shivat HaNeirot, all seven Neirot have to be pointing towards the face of the menorah. So a number of other Mepharshim say it actually means that all of the Neirot faced towards the Shulchan. That's the menorah was on one wall of the Heichal, and the Shulchan was on the other side, and the lamps of the menorah all pointed towards the front, were at the front of the menorah. If you think sort of the lamps there, there were big cups. So, you know, where did the wick go? Did the wick float in the center, or was the wick sort of at the edge? The wick was at the edge, and it was pointing towards the front. So that's a machloket. And there's also discussion amongst the Mepharshim what it means, Bahalotcha et HaNeirot, when you cause the lamps to go up. That's why didn't it just say when you light the lamps? Why does it say when you cause them to go up? Rashi suggests that it means that's what it's referring to, because the light, the flame rises, or suggests it also could mean that there was a step in front of the menorah, and that the Kohen who was lighting the menorah had to step up onto the step. We also learn from this that you have to, the Kohen when he lights the lamp, he has to keep his hand there till the flame is actually rising of its own accord, rather than just a quick touch. And we apply that halakha also when you light Shabbat candles, when you light Hanukkah candles. You don't just a touch of the shamash or the match or whatever it is. You have to hold it there till the wick is properly alight. In any event, I want to look here for starters at a very important Ramban. Ramban starts by quoting a Rashi. Not all the texts of Rashi have this, but a number of the Rishonim had this in their Rashi, and some of the Chumashim it's printed, some of the Chumashim it's not printed. Lama nismacha parshat menorah lechanukat hanasiim. Why does Parshat Bahalotcha begin with the parsha that deals with the menorah? Last week we learned the dedication of the Mishkan and the gifts that all the Nasiim brought. And then straight after, we learn the parsha of the menorah, which works out very well, of course, on Hanukkah, 8th day Hanukkah. Hanukkah, we learn the parsha of the Nasiim in any event. And then on 8th day, it's the longest weekday laning that we have. It's from the 9th day, 9, 10, 11, 12, plus the end of Parashat Nasor, and then the beginning of Parashat Bahalotcha, because it goes into that Bahalotcha Taneirot, which is very appropriate for Chanukah. But Rashi's asking, why is there this juxtaposition? Lefishek Shera'a Aharon Chanukat HaNasiim, because when Aaron realized that the Nasiim were all bringing these gifts for the dedication of the Mishkan, Chal Shadato, he became distressed, Shelo Haya Imahem B'Chanukah, that he wasn't part of their dedication of the Mishkan. He wasn't bringing a gift, Lo Hu V'Lo Shivto, neither him personally nor his tribe. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to him, Chayecha, don't worry, Shelcha Gdola Mishelahem, your engagement with the Mishkan is greater than theirs. Shata Madlikum Meitivat HaNeirot Bokav HaErev, because you're going to be lighting and tidying up the lamps every day, in the morning and in the evening. Lashon Rashi Midrash Agadah. So that's what Rashi says. Rashi's explaining that the end of last week's Sedra, Aaron HaKohen got distressed. That's why aren't I part of this? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, oh, don't worry. Here's Bahalotcha et HaNeirot. This is going to be your mitzvah. Now the Ramban is going to ask a number of fairly obvious questions on this Midrash. Velonit barerli. The Ramban says this doesn't make any sense to me. Lama nichamo bahadlakat nirot. That's, you know, what sort of consolation was it that Aaron was told that he was going to be lighting the lamps? Veloni chamo b'ktoret boker v'erev. Why didn't he say to him, well, listen, you know, you're offering up the ktoret every day. That's why I specially mentioned the neirot. Sheshibchu bo hakato v'yasimu ktorah ba'apecha. That's the relationship of Shevet Levi with the ktorah is, ktoret is mentioned in Parashat V'zot HaBracha. Uvachol ha-korbanot. Or mention any of the Kohanim, not the Kohanim, the Kohanim were busy in the Mishkan all the time. Or other avodot, including the avodah of Yom Kippur, which only the Kohen Kadol could do. Nichnas lifnai lifnim, when he went into the Holy of Holies. V'shehu kadosh Hashem on me behichalol l'sharatol l'varich bishmo. Or we can say more straightforwardly, you know, Aaron, why was Aaron HaKohen getting upset that he wasn't involved in the dedication of the Mishkan? All the other Shavatim, they were in and out. They each came one day, brought their gift, and that was it. Aaron was that Kadosh Hashem Omeit Bechalul Shartol Varich Mishmo. He was fully employed in the Beit Hamikdash, him and his tribe. V'shiv Tokulo Mesharte Elokeinu. That's Aaron and his tribe. You know, why were they upset? And if they were upset, that's why. What sort of consolation was there? Is to say, oh well, you've got the Neirot. That it's like, I suppose, that chief rabbi goes to a shul hachnasat sefer Torah. Right, so this one's given opening the ark, and another one's given hagban, and another one's given something else. Chief rabbi doesn't get anything. That's, no, he's the chief rabbi. You know, he gets the center stage. He gets the speech every time he goes somewhere. You know, he doesn't need to be upset. And oh, they give him a candle to hold. It's not really going to make him happy. Why was Aaron upset in the first place? In any event, Aaron's korban was greater than what the Nasim brought. Throughout the period of the Miluim, throughout these 12 days, that's whilst the Nasim were bringing their gifts, that's certainly for the 8 days of the Miluim, Aaron was offering up korban, plenty of korbanot all the time. So he was busy. It wasn't like he was excluded from the whole thing. So you might say, okay, well, maybe Aaron wasn't so excited by what he was doing because that was obligatory service. And he was distressed that he wasn't going beyond what was required like the others were. Well, then the Hadlakat Haneirot, lighting the lamps, also was obligatory, so that wasn't solving any problems. Aval, Inyan HaGadah Hazu. So now the Ramban is going to give us his explanation of what this is all about. Lidrosh Remez Min HaParashal Chanukah. That's Shel Neirot. Shayata Bavayit Sheini Al Yidei Aharon Uvanav. This is a remez in the Torah. This is a hint from the Torah about the Chanukah that we know about. The Chanukah at the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, the time of the Hasmoneans. They were descendants of Aaron and his children. Ritzoni Namach Hashmonai Kohen Gadol Uvanav. So it was a hint that this Medrash is telling us that there's some sort of hint in the Pesukim about the Chanukah, the time of the Hasmoneans, that was going to take place in the future. He says he's found in a hidden scroll or document of Rabbeinu Nissim, one of the earlier Sfadi Rishonim, Shehizkir HaGadah Hazuva Amar. Rabbeinu Nissim quotes this Agadah and says, Ra'iti b'midrash, I've seen in the Midrash, Kevan she'kriv v'shnei masa shvatim v'lo hikriv shevet levi v'chulei. Since the 12 tribes had offered up gifts And Shevet Levi had, and Tamar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moshe Dabel Aaron Vamar Taylav. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Moshe, have a word with Aaron, tell him, Yesh Chanukah Acheret Sheish Bahadlakat HaNeirot. There's going to be a Chanukah in the future when there is Hadlakat HaNeirot. Vani Oseh Bal Yisrael Al Yidei Banecha. And I will do for the Jewish people through your descendants, Nisim Utshua V'Chanukah Shekruya Al Shemam. I'll do miracles and salvation and a dedication of the Beit HaMikdash, which will be named after them. That is the Chanukah of the Hasmonean dynasty. That's why we have this juxtaposition, really to show that there was the Chanukat HaMizbeach, or the Chanukat HaMishkan, in the times of Moshe and Aaron in the Midbar, and then there was another Chanukah at some stage in the future, and Aaron was being promised that that was going, or the Medrash is suggesting that Aaron was being promised that he was going to be leading that rededication. V'ra'iti od b'yilmedenu, and I've seen in the Yilmedenu. Yilmedenu is a reference to the Medrash Tanchuma. Often passages in the Medrash Tanchuma begin Yilmedenu Rabbeinu. Our teachers should teach us. So when the Rishonim are referring to the Tanchuma, they refer to it as the Yilmedenu. V'chebu midbara. Bar amalo HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moshe, lechem o l'Aharon, go and say to Aharon, al titiare, don't be afraid, l'gdulam izot ha-tamuchan, you are destined for something greater than this. HaKorbanot kol zman shebeit ha-mikdash kayam hei noagin. The Korbanot, they're in effect whilst the Beit HaMikdash is standing. But once there's no Beit HaMikdash, there's no Korbanot. Aval HaNeirot lo'olam el mul p'nei hamnora ya'iru. The Neirot will always burn, at least in a certain sense, meaning the menorah of Chanukah. The chol ha'brachot she'natati lo levarech et banai einam betelin lo'olam. And all the brachot that you give also never cease to be. It's well known, there's no Beit HaMikdash, and the Korbanot cease to be, then the menorah in the Mishkan or the Beit HaMikdash also ceases to be. So obviously this medrash is referring to the lamps of the Chashmonai dynasty. That applies even after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Also the Birkat Kohanim, which comes at the other end of the Chanukah laning. That is also something which is permanent. Therefore, we've got a drasha about the parashot that come before and after this Chanukah laning, and this gives kavod to Aaron, who was excluded. So, what the Ramban is saying is really the midrash is telling us that there's some sort of hint that we've got a Chanukat HaMizbeach of the Nasiim in the Mishkan, and then that's followed by Aaron lighting the lamps, and that's telling us in some way that just as the Nasiim consecrated the Mishkan in the desert, likewise Aaron's descendants will reconsecrate the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim in the times of the Hasmoneans. And that's why, it still hasn't really explained why Aaron was upset or what he was distressed about, but certainly what he's done is he's explained to us that how this is a mollifying answer to the problem. Now, as I said at the outset, there's a machloket between, Rashi and other Mefarshim exactly how the Neirot were arranged, but certainly the Sforno says, like Rashi, that they were all pointing inwards, three on one side pointing towards the center lamp, three on the other side pointing towards the center lamp. There's a very nice Sforno here, which I think I've quoted on a Friday night in the past, but worth revisiting. The Sforno says, El mul Pnei HaMenorah, Shua Kaneh HaEmtzei. What's the Pnei HaMenorah? It's the middle branch of the menorah. V'zeh k'shetifne shall have it shall kol echad mishisha neirot el kaneh HaEmtzei. So when you have the flames of each of the six other lamps turning towards the middle lamp, Asya iru shivat hanerot, then all seven lamps will create their will shine. Kol hashiva ya'iru v'yashpiru or elyon Yisrael. All seven will illuminate a supernal light for the Jewish people. Sheyoru hayot or hayamanim v'or hasmalim m'chuvan ufone el or hakana hemtzei. So the light on the right side and the lights on the left side are all pointing towards the middle lamp. Shehu ikar hamenorah, which is the central part of the menorah. So what's the symbolism of this? V'shekein ra'ui shekavanat hamayminim ha'oskim b'chaye olam. So you have people on the right side, those who are involved in temporal matters. In spiritual matters, on the right. And those on the left wingers, dealing with temporal matters, who are supporting those on the right. That's were it not for what's going on in heaven above, then what's taking place down below would never be able to be effective. All this is to try and satisfy the will of Hashem. So that there's a common point that they're all focused on. And they will exalt Hashem's name together. As they've accepted to do, kasher he'ed ba'omro, v'yanu chol ha'am yachta v'yomru, kol asher diber Adonai na'aseh. Everybody is focused on Hashem. What the Sforno is saying is that the symbolism of these lamps is that you've got people on the right-hand side involved in spiritual matters, people on the left-hand side involved in temporal matters. They're all facing a shared middle point. They're all facing the same central point. I think we can develop this Sforno a little bit further. It's not just in terms of those on the right being spiritually inclined, those on the left being temporally inclined. But I think we can say, you know, in general, you know, you have people on the religious right, people on the religious left, the political right, the political left. That's, you know, in any group of people, you have a divergence of views. That's, it doesn't matter on which side of the shul you find yourself, provided that everybody's looking towards the same center point. That's if you're looking towards the same center point, then it doesn't matter. Then you'll be able to find synergy and common ground. That's its problem is when you've got people are those on the right are looking outwards to the right, and those on the left are looking outwards to the left. Then there's not going to be any meeting of minds. And I think, you know, learning from the Sforno, what it's saying is that not everybody has to be at the same place, you know, on the spectrum. That everybody has to be focused on the same shared common goal, and then that's a recipe for success. So that's the opening part of this week's Sedra, is the menorah. We then have various other episodes or themes. We've got the consecration of the Levium, and then we've got Pesach Sheni. Don't want to deal today with either of those, but I want to jump to Perek Yud. At the beginning of Perek Yud, Vaydaber Adonai Moshe Lemor, Hashem spoke to Moshe, saying, Asei lecha, make for yourself, Shtei chatzotzrot kesef, two trumpets of silver, Mitsha ta'aseh otam, you shall make them of beaten metal, Vayulik lecha lemikra ha'idah, ulamasayt hamachanot, and you'll use them either to, or both to, gather the people, and also as a sign that people need to travel on and go forward. So these chatzotrot were there for a practical purpose. They served a practical purpose. The Gemara tells us that we learn from Vahayu Lecha Lemikra Haida that the chatzotrot that Moshe Rabbeinu made were only for him, that they weren't shared with future generations, and when he died, they were hidden away. And in actual fact, future generations didn't use chatzotrot. They used chatzotrot in the Beit HaMikdash for the korbanot, but they didn't use chatzotrot for these purposes. So the question arises, why is it that these chatzotrot were limited specifically for Moshe's use? So I want to share with you two answers to that question. Let's start with Rav Hirsch, who says, probably the difference between Moses and all that came after him was kept in the minds of those that followed him just by this. So he's saying that this was a way of communicating to the people the uniqueness of Moshe Rabbeinu. The V'lo kam navi od b'Yisrael was most strikingly expressed thereby. This was a way of showing that Moshe Rabbeinu was unique amongst the Nevi'im. The trumpets, which had called leaders and people to Moses, were not allowed to be set to the mouth of anybody else after his death. There was something so special about this that it couldn't be shared with everybody else. I suppose it's a bit like, you know, you go to Bevis Marks Synagogue. You know, you've got Sir Moses Montefiore's seat there, you know, and there's chains over it, you know, not for anybody else to sit in. And so here you've got Moshe Rabbeinu's trumpets, not to be shared with anybody else. So Rav Hirsch says the reason why these were unique was to stress the uniqueness of Moshe Rabbeinu. Let's turn over the page and look at something from Menachem Sachs in his Sefer Menachem Tzion. We've seen this Sefer on a number of occasions before. Tanu Rabbanan, so he quotes the Gemara, Kol HaKelim Sha'asa Moshe K'shem No K'shem Nadorot. All the implements and vessels that Moshe Rabbeinu made were kosher for him to use and could be used by future generations. Chatzotrot K'sherot Lo P'sulot Nadorot. However, the Chatzotrot, these trumpets, they were valid for him, but they were invalid for future generations. My Tama, what's the reason? Da Amakra, because the Pasuk says, Asay Lecha, make them for you. Lecha, lecha, tre zimne. So it says that actually the word that's lecha twice in those in that second pasuk. I say lecha shtei chatzotrot and v'hayu lecha, and they will be for you. I say lecha v'hayu lecha, lecha v'lo l'dorot, for you and not for future generations. Now he's going to give us a very insightful explanation as to why they weren't for future generations. Hachatzotrot shem shu klei tishdoret v'tikshoret le'esof hamachanot u'lahasi'am. These chatzotrot were a mode of communication. They were a way of communicating with the people to gather them together or to set them on their journeys. V'halalu lo shimshu ela l'sha'a. And these chatzotrot were only effective at that time. L'moshe u'l'doro b'amidbar. For Moshe and his generation in the wilderness. Because the mode of communication changes from one generation to another generation. Zmanan over v'sivran batel. They've had their time. That's what's a good way of communicating in one generation is a bad way of communicating in the next generation. So if future generation you want to gather the people and get them travelling, you have to use a current, modern, contemporary form of communication. I suppose if you think about it, that, you know, and this is true on so many levels, both in terms of the medium used and also in terms of, I would say, the content. You know, you think, you know, I sort of look back in my files, you know, sort of that newsletters that I produced, you know, 23 years ago when I was first a rabbi. You know, I said, you know, these were cutting edge, you know, did the, you know, double-sided on a daisy wheel printer. That's, you know, and, you know, the shul thought they had, you know, a technical whiz as their rabbi, right? You know, if that was the way I was, you know, communicating with my membership now, that, you know, I would be thought of as, you know, a dinosaur. That's, you know, if Facebook is the way of communicating now, or Snapchat, or WhatsApp, or whatever it is, you've got to use it. You've got to embrace it to get your message across. If you kept the Chatzot Zerot of Moshe Rabbeinu, that's, you know, then, you know, that's just not going to be an effective way of communicating your message nowadays. The that's in terms of the Klei HaTikshoret, the... you know, the mode of communication. The content also, that, so at least the way you present it, you know, needs to be, you know, appropriate, that's for the generation. You know, I saw in one of the Svarim pointed out that, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu used Chatzot Zerot, Yoshua used the Shofar, David HaMelech used the Kinor. So each of them had their own way of communicating the message. And of course, each prophet spoke in a slightly different language. The ultimate product always needs to be the same, but the way of communicating it, you know, will change. And, you know, to say that, you know, this is the way we're going to communicate our message because that's the way it was always done before, that, you know, is not necessarily positive. I remember when I was one of the earliest rabbis to introduce an emailed newsletter. That's when I was in Belmont. That's JC got wind of it, and there was even you know, an article that's you know, in the JC that's you know, about it. You know, that's a new innovation. That I remember, you know, people in the show were up in arms about it. You know, they thought it was they thought it was terrible. Yeah, they did. They did. That's Tal. Tal, if you want, if you're struggling, I don't mind. I really don't mind.
That's the GDPR.
Well, that's right. That's right. But in any event, you know, this is an important, you know, an important message here that, you know, you've got to be effective. Okay, perhaps the most famous psukim in the Sedra, Vayihibin Saharon Vayomer Moshe Kuma Adonai Vayafutzoy Vecha Vayanusu Misanecha Mipanecha. Uvnu choyomar, and when the Aaron came to rest, Shuva Adonai Revot Alfei Yisrael. And as we can even see here, there are the two backward nuns that bracket these psukim. So the first question is, why do these psukim, why do they seem to be bracketed? That's, so Rashi says, Vayhibin Saharon, Asa lo simaniot lefanavu lacharav. These psukim have signs at the beginning and at the end. Lomar she'ein ze mekomo, or to say this passage, these psukim don't really belong here. Really belongs in Parshat Bamidbar. That would be, you know, much more appropriate, where it's talking about the arrangement of the camps, that, and where the Aaron was. It'd be much better to put it there. That v'lama nichtav kan. So why is it inserted here? K'dei lahafsik bein puranut lepuranut, to make a distinction between the two disasters that occurred. K'dita b'chol kitvei hakodesh, as the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat tells us. Now the question is, what are these two disasters? Look in the Siftei Chachamim. So we see the next psukim, that's that the people were kmitonanim rabosnei Hashem. They were complaining, looking for excuses to rebel against Hashem. So that's a puranut, that's a disaster. We understand that. Ela puranut rishona, but what's the previous disaster? Look through the previous psukim. Chapter 10, verses 29 through to 34. That's about talking about Yitro. that Yitro was with them and Yitro wanted to go and Moshe Rabbeinu said stay. That's, you know, that's the, where's there a Puranut there? So the Siftei Chachamim says, "Dichtiv le'el minei." What's the previous pasuk before Vayehi bin Saharon, or two pasukim before Vayisu me'ahar Hashem? It says, "And they travelled from the mountain of Hashem." That Havalei le'meima Vayisu me'ahar Elokim. It should have said the mountain of God using the Shem Elokim. But their attitude was when they traveled, they were like tinok haborech mi beit hasefer, like kids running out from school at the end of the day. Right? They turned away from Hashem. I always want to quote this on Friday nights of Parashat Bahalokha. You know, there are always people in shul that, you know, they can't get out on Friday night quick enough. You know, once we hit Kiddush, that's, you know, that's, you know, let's go already. We pasnish to stay for the end. That's a puranut. That's to be so such a hurry to leave such a great place is a puranut.
They're inside and not outside.
Well, exactly. That's perhaps why I don't say anything. That's okay. So why the nuns? Why the nuns? That's look at the Balaturim. Asa nunin hafuchin. We have backward nuns, and there are different ways of writing the backward nuns. If you look in different types, different Sifrei Torah, you'll see slightly different ways of writing them. That's but in principle, they are backwards nuns. So asan nunin hafukin sheratzala havir hashavatim sheot yotehem nun et hayardein shehu rachav nun. So we've got these nuns because at this point in time, when the Bnei Israel were about to travel, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to take the shvatim. If you count up all the letters of the shvatim, there are 50 letters. I haven't checked it. I confess I haven't checked it. There are 50 letters. He wanted to take them across the Yardane, which was 50 amot wide. I don't know where he gets the notion that it was 50 amot wide. He was saying it's a sifri in Devarim Midrash Halacha. So number 50 is relevant. So put in backward nuns. You could have put in upside down gimels as well, but backward nuns is symbolic. Ela shachit garam. But the people sinned, and therefore they didn't go across the Yardei. Presumably referring to the sin of either this sin or the sin of the Meraglim. Tama chelu nun in hafuchin. Another reason for the inverted nuns. Kedita b'shabbat per kol kitvei. As Gemara Masechet Shabbat says, she'ezeh mekomah, k'tav akan, la'avzik bein puranut rishonah le'puranut shniyah, to break between the puranuyot, v'asa nun in hafuchin, and we've got backward nuns, lomar she'mekomah lifnei nun parashiyot lefaneha. Really, it should come 50 paragraphs earlier. That's the ilu loha yuhanunin hafuchin. If the nunim weren't backwards, loha itiyotem lifnei gimul nun parashiyot lefaneha, im lifnei gimul nun lachareha. I wouldn't know whether it's supposed to be 50 parashiyot previously or 50 parashiyot subsequently. Therefore, they're turning backwards. Go back, that's where it really belongs. That's why they're backwards to say it's 50 parashiyot paragraphs previously. So if somebody gets a bit bored during the laning on Shabbat, saying we should really have come after Bamidbar chapter 2, verse 17. That was an asa ol moed machaneh levim b'toch ha-machanot, that the ol moed, the camp of the Levim, traveled amongst the machanot. Kashe yachanu king Yisoi shal yador ledigleher. So again, I haven't counted up, but be interesting to see. He says there are 50 paragraphs there.
What was the event?
A disaster. That's what a Puran is. Something bad happening. So I understand, the complaints is something bad. You say, no, the fact there's a bad episode in the annals of Jewish history. The fact that they were at Har Sinai should never have the sense, oh, right, like, glad to be on our way now. You know, even though you're going to Eretz Israel, but there's this sense of, yeah, they're itching to move from there. That's how can you be itching to move from from Har Sinai? That's
I think worried that it's a bit somewhere, isn't worried that you get more mitzvahs to do.
Right, it should have been hard to tear them away from Har Sinai. Instead, they were, Ketinok HaBoreach, it was far too easy for them. Let's skip to the Pesukim at the bottom. V'asastufa shebekibohi tavu tava. So, amongst the troubles in the Midbar, we've got the rabble that was with them, Hitavu Tava, they desired to desire, Vayashuvu Vayvku Gam Bnei Israel. Bnei Israel also went back and cried, Vayomru, and they said, Mi Achilenu Basar. That's who will feed us with meat. So Rashi tells us the Asaf Suf, the rabble was the Erev Rav. That's the mixed multitude that came out, and that's why it says, and then Gam Bnei Israel, also Bnei Israel joined in. And they said, who's going to give us meat? We remember the free fish that we got in Mitzrayim. That's the kishuim, the courgettes, or the cucumbers, and the avatichim, the watermelons, v'etechatzir, I think that's leeks, v'etabatzalim, and the onions, v'etashumim, the garlics. All these wonderful foods. V'atah nafshinu v'eshayin kol. Now our souls are dried up. There's nothing. Bilti el haman einenu. All we've got is the man. Now, what sort of complaint was this? It tasted of whatever they wanted. It was easy to get. It was provided from heaven. Came fresh every day. Okay, a little bit monotonous. But, at the end of the day, that's, you don't have to work for it. That's, you don't have to do much for it. What's the problem? But besides that, what are they talking about? They got this free fish. Look at Rashi. Asher nochal b'Mitzrayim chinam. Tomash in Mitzrayim notnim lahem dagim chinam. You think that the Egyptians gave fish for nothing to the Israelites? V'alok v'anema. We've got a passage that tells us again. Tevin lo yinatein lachem. They weren't even giving them the straw to make the bricks to build the pyramids. That's a kamachomer. They weren't getting the fish. They show up to get the straw. No straw for you, but here's half a pound of smoked salmon. That's unlikely. Im temin lo hayu notnim lahem chinam, kavachomer dagim. So they weren't getting straw for nothing. Certainly they weren't getting fish for nothing. Umani omer chinam. So what does it mean that they got it for nothing? Chinam min ha-mitzvot. They didn't have to do any mitzvot. That's what was bothering them. The man came with a condition. The man came with a condition I'm going to test the Jewish people. Are they going to follow my laws or not? If they follow my laws, then they'll get the man. If they don't, they won't. That's, they've got to toe the line. And even if you don't say the mitzvot directly related to the man, but, they got the mitzvot and they got the man. And you know what? The two came together and they kind of prefer to be without the mitzvot and without the man. That's what they're saying. Chinam means chinam min ha-mitzvot. That's Rashi's interpretation. Rav Yosef Bechor Shor, he says a bit differently. He says, no, they maybe they did get the fish for free. Asher nochal b'Mitzrayim chinam. Lefisha lo yomru lahem b'Mitzrayim ha'item ochlim b'damim v'kan atem ochlim haman b'lo shum damim. So that Moshe wouldn't say, well, listen, you had to pay for your food in Mitzrayim. Now you're getting free food. L'kach amru, no, chinam, we got it for nothing. So how did they get it for nothing? G'shem of Mitzrayim shayah ha'yor mashkek gan hayarak. Rav Yosef Bechor Shor says it might be that in Mitzrayim, Mitzrayim had the Nile going right through it, right? And maybe there was just so much fish, overflowing from the river that Hayu Edvarim Hepahefka, fish in Mitzrayim was so plentiful that even the slaves could take it. There was just so much fish around, everybody could have it. That's what he's surmising.
Maybe also you forget the bad things when you something. When they had to work like dogs to get the food,
right?
Maybe they forget all that, and you think, oh.
Okay, so it could be a matter of perception, definitely.
It's not pretty much only talking about 2 months after they left. Mm. Not talking like decades.
No. This was a year after, but okay. Even so,
it's a year after 200-something years of slavery. Exactly.
Yeah. That's so. Shadal, in his commentary, he makes the observation that. This might well have been just the practice in Mitzrayim that the slaves were fed fish. He quotes from from the inscription on a pyramid. If you look 3 lines down, V'chein matzinu b'heirodot ki al pyramid achat asher b'Mitzrayim, that on a certain pyramid in Mitzrayim hayakatuv ki amelach asher hikimota. It's written in hieroglyphics that the king, the pharaoh that built it, Hotzi Elef Sheshmiot Kikarim, Beshumim Salim Tsnunot, Farnasata Polim Ashe Banuota. He spent 1,600 talents, I guess, of silver on garlic and onions and the like for the slaves who built it. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, in his passage Emet Liyakov, raises an interesting question and gives an interesting answer. We won't look at it inside. He asks as follows: he says, where do Chazal get it from that this is what they had, the Israelites had in mind when they said, that we got for the fish that we got chinam? That's they said we got it for free, right? Where do Chazal get the notion for free means free from the mitzvot? What's wrong with the what's wrong with the pshat? So in part the answer would be that it doesn't make sense that they got it free. He says it's more than that. He says, very perceptive, he says that the Israelites, they did say we got it for free. And that's what they were kind of believing. But that's just a stupid thing to say. It doesn't make any sense to say that the Israelites were talking about getting free fish in Mitzrayim. They could never have been getting free fish in Mitzrayim. But rather, psychologically, even though that's what they were saying, they must have had something else in mind. And it says often that you'll complain about something and the complaint doesn't make any sense. And the case is that in actual fact you're really complaining about something else, but you can't you can't express it. Yeah. That's a person will complain about something in the workplace. Maybe they'll complain about their desk is or something like that. It's not really the desk that's bothering them. It's the manager that's bothering them or something like that. It's very often you'll have something else. A person will complain about something. You've got to get behind what they're actually saying and work out what's going on psychologically there. So part of that episode was the question or the episode of the 70 elders, and they were chose to support Moshe Rabbeinu, and they gained a degree of prophecy. Vayirid Adonai Ba'anan Vayidaber Elav Vayatzel Min HaRuach Asher Alav Vayitin Al Shivim Ish Hazakinim. So Hashem spoke to Moshe and he took some of the spirit that was on him and gave it or shared it with the 70 elders. Vayikun Noach Alehem HaRuach, and it was when the spirit rested on them. Vayit Naba'u V'lo Yasafu. They prophesied V'lo Yasafu. Now, not clear what v'lo yasafu means. Rashi gives us two possibilities. V'lo yasafu, lo nitnabu el oto hayom levado. They only prophesied on that day. They didn't continue prophesying more than that. Kach mufurash b'sifri. That's what the Sifri says. V'ungulos tirgem lo paskan. They didn't stop prophesying. Shelo paskan nevua mehem. That's they were prophets forever. Rav Moshe Sternbach in Tam V'dat cites a very interesting statement from the Ktav Sofer. Ktav Sofer, the son of the Chatam Sofer. B'Ktav Sofer mefut mefarish shelo hosifu al mashenet sal alehem achshav. What does it mean v'lo yasafu? They didn't, we just translated, they didn't continue. Either they didn't stop or they didn't continue. V'lo yasafu, less off something, means to gather something in. Right? They didn't gather any more than what they'd received from Moshe. When you've got elders, not old people, but elders, that they always have to be making progress. They have to be amongst those, the holchim, those who are moving, and progressing. That it's clear from proof of this from Eldad Umeidad Shlo Hisigu Anavua Me'alehem Alidei Madregatam El Tzorach Sha'ar Nizrukah Behem Nevua. That Eldad and Meidad, what was the problem? The problem was they just got a temporary Nevua, and we're told that they didn't add to it. Lachein lo hosifu l'hitnabei. They were satisfied with the degree of nevuah that they were given. Umusa yesh bazel ibnei Torah. And he says there's good Musa lesson here for Bnei Torah. Shekdei lahasig ma'alot ruchaniyot. If you want to reach spiritual heights, asol lahamid ela tamid lihitameitz ulalot ba'avodat Hashem. You can never stand still. You always have to be progressing. You mustn't be giving prophecy, we're not really adding anything, not really becoming better at it. Here's the thing, these were second-rate Nevi'im at best, or third-rate Nevi'im. That's they were happy with what they had, they didn't want to achieve more. No, you always have to be trying to achieve more. Yes, David.
Normally we say that Novi has to say exactly as he's been told. He shouldn't add or take away.
Correct. This is a different type of Nevuah. In terms of...
Not the exact words, though.
Yeah. In terms of, you may as well ask, what does it mean? You know, there were 70 people here who were being Nevi'im. What Nevuah were they giving? Now, what was their Nevuah? So Rashi tells us that their Nevuah was, they were saying that, they're saying that Moshe was going to die and that Yahshua would lead the people into the land. That's one statement, right? And so what does it mean they were Nevi'im? You know, you see with Shaul, right, in Sefer Shmuel, you see Shaul was amongst the Nevi'im. You know, and when David HaMelech played the music, you know, a spirit of prophecy descended on them. You know, so the prophet, clearly being a prophet, you know, has a number of, number of manifestations. You know, you've got, you know, Yechezkel and Shai, Yirmiah, you know, they had specific prophecies. Whereas here it seems they had, you know, the spirit of Hashem about them, and they were able to teach and pray on behalf of the people, etc. I don't think it really means that they were sort of, you know, sitting there giving fortune telling, or that they were, you know, necessarily rebuking the people. Oh, beware you sinners, the Lord saith. So I don't think it was necessarily that. But the point is, they were, so excited to be this type of, you know, they got Nevuah, but they... Lo yasafu. They didn't want to add to it. They didn't want to improve it. The end of the Sedra, that deals with the Lashon Hara that Miriam and Aaron spoke about Moshe Rabbeinu. V'atadabe Miriam v'Aharon b'Moshe alodot ha'ishakushit ha'she lakach ki shakushit lakach. So they spoke about the Ethiopian woman, or the Cushite woman that he'd taken, for he had taken a Cushite woman. That's Vayomru, and they said, Harakach b'Moshe diber Adonai, how long can Banu diber? Did Hashem only speak to Moshe? Didn't he also speak to us? So the question is, of course, they haven't really been clear what they were saying wrong. what were they saying wrong about Moshe's wife? So there's a certain amount of discussion that Rashi says that it must be they were saying that, talk about the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu became celibate after his experience on Har Sinai. They'd overheard, or Sipora had overheard, Miriam had overheard Sipora complaining about it. And they said, you know, Moshe thinks he's better than the rest of us. That Hashem's spoken to us as well. We're not celibate. He doesn't need to be better than the rest of us. Other Mepharshim say, the point is that they say, oh, Moshe Rabbeinu's married a Cushite woman. None of the local girls are good enough for him. That, you know, it's he thinks he's better than everybody else just because Hashem's spoken, you know, to him. So he has to go and marry a princess. That was the Lashon Hara. And one or two other suggestions as well. It occurred to me that why does nobody say that they were just being racist about Sipora? That, you know, they're saying, he's got this, you know, he's got a black wife, you know, that's, you know, emphasizing the fact that he's married to a black woman. That occurred to me, maybe the reason why that doesn't appear as a possibility is just because it's impossible. That's the notion of racism, you know, for Am Yisrael, it's just, you know, it doesn't exist.
It does say somewhere in Shulchan Aruch about certain things that you give birth, if you're certain thing, you give birth to not to swarthy children or something like that. Kind of.
Yeah, that doesn't necessarily mean that. Yes, yes. But there it's not. Okay, I mean, you've got questions you can ask, but it occurred to me that that might be, that might be an approach. That, let's finish off with what Rav Munk says. Rav Munk says that it's important that the Torah hasn't told us exactly what they've said. And the above discussion still does not answer the question. Why does the Torah abstain from telling us specifically what Miriam and Aaron said against Moshe? Perhaps the Torah purposely did not want to limit the prohibition against slander to any specific case, whether of a neighbor, a relative, a leader, or indeed of anyone. Indeed, the Torah wanted to forbid any word that has the potential for hurting someone, wherever it may be and whatever it may be. So what they said is not important. The fact is, they said something which was insulting to Moshe Rabbeinu. That was the problem. And that's why they got into trouble for it. Okay, so that's tonight. That's Parashat Baha Lotcha. As of next week, there's no